Hello, everyone. This is Eric Pennington, and welcome to the Spirit of EQ podcast. We're glad that you've tuned in. A few things we wanted to tell you at the beginning of the show, and that's this podcast was created to be a tool to help you, primarily to discover and grow your EQ. Science and our own lived experiences confirm that the better we are at managing our emotions, the better we're going to be at making decisions, which leads to a better life. And that's something we all want. We're glad that you've taken out the time today to listen and hope that something that you hear will lead to a breakthrough. Hey, one last thing. We'd really appreciate a review on whichever platform you use to listen. And if you want to, leave some comments about what you heard today, as well as follow and subscribe. That way you won't miss a single episode as we continue this journey. And with that, the show begins. Mickey Leibowitz.
Eric Pennington. Always
good to see you again.
Always a treat to be with you, friend.
Wow, my gosh. I'm going back in my memory banks. I'm thinking, is this the third time we've had you on the show?
It's the third time.
Yeah, this is great.
Hopefully this time I can get it right.
Oh, well, no, I won't put that pressure on you. However, for our audience, and I probably haven't verbalized this directly to you, and I certainly haven't done it on the show. One of the reasons why I'm glad that you come back is because the healthcare system that we are in inside of the United States, though it is probably one of the most, if not the most advanced medicine, healthcare, whatever you want to use to describe it, we should be much further along, I think. And I don't think that's necessarily just confined to, you know, finding a cure or introducing a new pharmaceutical, but it's that patient-doctor relationship. And what I consider to be, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit today, I know we talked about it before we recorded, about the business model way of running healthcare versus what once was, it was all centered around a doctor-patient kind of concept. But you've got some great insights. I know you've got a new book that's going to be released here soon in October. And I just really want to start today by digging in maybe from the perspective of, so what do you think is the state of the healthcare system that we're in today? And again, I won't ask you to like confine it to, are there new drugs on the horizon or whatnot, but think of it in terms of as physicians and patients and maybe what's missing and quite frankly, maybe what's good.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but maybe let's start on the upbeat. And that is, if you ever had to practice medicine, this is the year to do it. And the reason why I say that is because every year, and I could say it every year going forward, the diagnostics and the treatments are better than the year before. And as an endocrinologist and a diabetes doctor, and I could certainly say without question that the treatments and diagnostics that we have now are better this year than they were last year. And next year, they're gonna be better than they are this year. So the modalities that we have with insulin pumps and continuous glucose monitors, as an example, have transformed the practice of endocrinology and diabetes. And you could say that with many fields, surgical fields and their surgical techniques. And you could say that with oncologic patients with cancer and all the new treatments that are amazing in so many different ways and have helped so many different people. So in that regard, it's a wonderful time to be practicing medicine, and next year will be better than this year. So that's awesome. Mm-hmm. On the other side, the thing that concerns me the most is that we might have lost, as we advance the technologies, we might have lost some of that that ability to really connect with people. You know, I've been doing this for 40 years, and I still believe that what people need the most is feeling cared for.
Mm-hmm.
People need to feel seen, understood, heard, valued, and appreciated. That's what they want. So you could have all the best technologies, all the best treatments, but if a person, a patient, doesn't feel connected with you, doesn't feel cared for by you, doesn't feel that trust, they might not be willing to pursue those treatments that might be being offered, because the trust is fundamental, it's foundational, and people need to feel cared for. And I give you many examples of situations that I've experienced personally and my families, where people have been seen by wonderfully skilled clinicians, but have not accepted the offering of the treatments because they didn't have that connection and they didn't feel that trust.
You know, it's interesting when you say that too. Randomly, I was in a hospital system lab and getting blood work done, and I always do this. You know, I'll strike up a conversation. You know, how's your day going? You know, and then it leads to blah blah blah. But this particular time, the lady, somehow we got on the topic of, you know, good doctors versus bad doctors, that kind of thing. And I know that's kind of relative, you know, because perception and experience can vary. But she mentioned that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had gone to a large cancer care system, I guess if I can call it that. And the oncologist was pretty much, "You're going to do these three things, and that's the end of the story. And have a nice day. I'll see you next week." And they'll get you scheduled. And she was still in kind of a bit of a shock with the diagnosis and, you know, the things that every human being would experience, right? Am I gonna live to see my grandkids? And does this mean death? I mean, all that kind of. And then you got a physician that pretty much has dismissed and gone to, "This is how we're gonna do it. This is the way. Goodbye." She had sort of that something in her that said that I don't feel comfortable. So she decided to look for another oncologist in another system. And it was night and day. I mean, it was almost to the point, Mickey, and you could see the change in her demeanor telling me this, right? So I, you know, you and I have had many conversations about emotions and EQ and what impact, right? But it was clear to me that this particular physician's emotional intelligence was so high that this woman, she was expressing hope, she was expressing connection, and quite frankly, adherence to what was going to be asked of her, and confidence, right? Now, and you know this, Mickey, that physician didn't guarantee her anything, didn't make any promises, couldn't. I mean, there's no way. But what he could do, and he did it so well, was he did exactly as you described there at the end of your answer. So I wanted to bring that out to you, say, hey, you're right. It's out there. It lives.
Yeah, what a difference an individual can make for another individual. So we've had a recent experience with my granddaughter who had a fractured ankle. She's a dancer, and so she fractured her ankle. And we went to a very reputable pediatric orthopedic surgeon, and I went to the office visit with my daughter and my granddaughter, and the orthopedic surgeon. I could tell right from the beginning, you know, he was going to be very transactional in his approach. And how could I tell? Well, you know, he walked in. He happened to be a gentleman, and he shook our hand. But as he shook our hand, he wasn't looking at us. He wasn't making that eye contact, and he was really, frankly, looking at his computer on his desk and sitting down. And in a very transactional way, describing what the situation was and the treatment management. And they were all legitimate diagnosis and treatment options.
Right.
My daughter and I walked out and we said, something's missing there. So she, who's a pit bull, finds another pediatric orthopedic surgeon. And this time it happened to be a woman. And by the way, no disrespect to men, but women in general tend to have higher emotional intelligence than men. Not
That's
to
been my experience as well.
Well, that's what the literature says also. Not to say that, I mean, emotional intelligence is a competency, it's learnable. So anybody can learn it, whether you're a man or a woman. But just for this particular situation, it happened to be a woman, an orthopedic surgeon. And when she walked in, completely different scenario, just like you described, eye contact, a caring, touch, a generous listening, listening with curiosity, listening with for content, intent, and emotion, trying to pick up, what the disappointment was that my granddaughter would have to stop dancing for a period of time, and she could really be empathic, put herself in our shoes, and in the same amount, this is the most interesting thing to me, in the same amount of time as the first orthopedic surgeon, she was able to connect with us, give us the same treatment plan and diagnose and treatment plan, and we walked out totally satisfied compared to the first experience.
You
And
stole my thought there, Mickey, because I'm thinking to myself, equal amount of time spent, but
equal amount of time.
yeah, that is so amazing to me. Can we and I know there may be more to unpack there, but can we talk about that transactional idea, right? Because when I think of a transaction, and it's just in my head, I think of you're at the grocery store, there are two people in front of you, the second person, and then you're next, and they scan your items. It's this amount of money. You pull out your credit card to pay and stuff, and then there's three people behind you, and it's just a constant flow. There's really no, I mean, it's just is that kind of where we're going with this? I mean, is when you talk about transactional?
Yeah, it's a so again, I've been doing it for a long time, and when I think about the practice of medicine, I always think back of like, why did I choose medicine to begin with? And my own personal mission statement then, and frankly, has carried me through my adult life, goes back to a Hebrew saying called Tikkun Olam, and Tikkun Olam is translated into repair the world or make the world better, so that when you leave the world, it's a little bit better than when you left it. Now, listen, I'm not going to fix the entire world. I wish I could. I would do it in a heartbeat. But I chose medicine because I thought that caring for other people, especially at the most vulnerable time, would be my way to repair the world.
Wow,
So
that's
what's
awesome.
happened over the course of time? So I went to medicine. Maybe a little naive, but very, certainly very idealistic, that I was going to practice medicine old school. I was going to be very competent. I was going to train very hard, which I did, and with humility, I was able to achieve many high awards and whatnot, being the best list of doctors in America year in and year out. But I combined competence with deep caring. That was my mission and my motto over the course of over years. But what ended up happening over the course of time is that the business of medicine started to gradually and progressively creep into the practice of medicine. And so my particular story, which I wrote about in my first book, which is called Losing My Patients, which is still available on Amazon.com if you're asking. I wrote
Thank you for
about
that.
it. I don't know if that's cheap advertisement, but it is. I admit it. It is. But I was put in a position. I was at that particular time. I was employed. I was an employed physician, and the business person came up to me after a couple 3 years of being in the practice. He goes, "You got to see more patients to make the same amount of money, or we're going to dock you if you still see the dock your pay if you see the same number of patients." And I was like, "Hey, what are you talking about? First of all, as an endocrinologist, I mean, I made enough money, but in the grand scheme of things, I was the low end of income for clinicians. Okay, no big deal. I loved endocrinology. I love the physiology. I love the pathophysiology. I love the patients and their conditions, and that most of them are treatable. I would do it in a heartbeat again, no question." But I said to him, "Well, why would you dock me? I'm on the I'm you know a nice reputation, excellent reputation in my community. I have a waiting list the size of California. Why are you docking me? I'm doing everything that I intended to do. But I wasn't meeting that quota, even though I could not work any harder than I was, and I could not safely see any more patients than I was seeing. So in the end, I was faced with a dilemma of, do I continue on in the practice of medicine, or do I try something different? And in the words of Robert Frost, I took a different path, and frankly, in the end, it made all the difference. And I pursued other course of medicine. But that's, to me, that was the beginning of being faced with medicine being a transactional experience. And I didn't want to succumb to that. And so I left that particular place where I was practicing medicine, and I continue to practice medicine, but more along my own terms going forward.
So when before we were recording, I was mentioning to you that, in the area I live, there are very few private practices anymore. Most of the physician groups or our physicians are employees of hospital systems, right? With some exception, but the vast majority, it seems. Do you believe that that is contributing to this transactional style of practicing medicine?
I do. Unfortunately, there has been the continued shift, and it's a little disappointing because I was very encouraged back when the Affordable Care Act came into being around 2010 or so, and there was a shift from volume to value, from quantity to quality. In fact, for 7 years, I was a senior medical quality director at a hospital, which I thoroughly enjoyed that position because it gave me an opportunity to put in systems that could enhance the safety of our patients and make our hospital more efficient and even more cost effective. So that was my goal at that particular time, is to do all that. But over the course of these last many years, this business model has, I think, at least in part, overtaken, except for fewer situations where you still can get somebody who, is deeply caring, who's in it for the patient, clinician relationship, as
So,
opposed to
Mickey.
just being in it for, I gotta, see as many patients as I can and move them through the system. And I don't think, listen, I know clinicians. I've been around them for a long time. I know nurses. I've been around them for a long time, and they are some of the smartest, most amazing people that I've ever met. But I think the system doesn't allow them necessarily, or easily allow them, to be able to practice the way that they might have initially intended to practice, with this
You know
care
what's
and
interesting
confidence.
that you say that, because one of the competencies in our EQ model, of which you are a practitioner of as well, is optimism, right? And I always use that when I'm giving a talk or just even one-on-one with folks, is that optimism is a key component to innovation, right? And as much as it may sound to our audience that we have we're talking about how bad it is, and it is to a degree, I get it. And you were great in mentioning the upside side of the equation, the positive. But maybe some of this transactional business-oriented approach is going to birth some of that innovation, right? That maybe there's a group of doctors out there who are saying, the only way we're going to be able to practice medicine in a way that benefits the patient is if we do, and then fill in the blank with whatever that innovation may be. And I get it. That might require that they make less money for 5 years or so, or they may have to, gather up an investor from the private sector, whatever you might to use. But I guess what I'm seeing, Mickey, is the possibility that maybe the resistance and the opposition is going to create some needed innovation, right? Because what I was about ready to say to you as you were talking is, you might, I don't know how prevalent it is where you're at, but here there's this idea of the concierge doctor, right? And they operate outside of the insurance world. They don't accept insurance. And it's like a subscription model. A great example would be you pay me $125 a month, and then you can see me as often as you need. Your appointments, you can get in whenever you want. And again, they still can prescribe and they still can order tests and things of that nature, which would more than likely be covered by insurance. But as far as the work that you do with that physician, it's called concierge, right? And I think to myself, I go, that could be something of possibility. But I also realize th there's the financial thing, right? Getting it up off of the ground, the investment that you have to make into all of those things. So as you're talking about that, I think there's that glimmer of optimism I have that maybe some of this will lead to some innovation, even beyond a concierge type of program.
Yeah. Well, you raise an interesting point as usual, Eric. And the thing is the concierge practice, and I was considering that when I left my practice back in 2009 or 2007 I left, and the book came out in 2009. But I considered being a concierge doctor, and I think it would have been very successful. My issue with that was that I would be limiting my practice to only those who could pay. And that was, to me, at that particular time, it didn't sit well. And I wanted to be available to anybody who wanted and who needed the type of care that I could deliver, care and caring that I could deliver. So I at that particular time, I was against it. But you're right, it's an outgrowth of the current systems. And these are and many of the physicians and clinicians that have started these concierge types of boutique practices have said, you know what, the system isn't working for me. I still want to practice medicine, but I want to be able to practice it on my own terms. I want to be able to give that competent care, and I also want to give the caring care that people really desire. So that has been an outgrowth. One of the things that is also an option, an opportunity potentially in the future, since you raise optimism, is artificial intelligence. And can artificial intelligence in some way allow the clinicians to be able to focus more on the patient and less on their computers and all the information that they are constantly inputting or receiving from there? As an example, and it's still in the early phase, so I don't want to say it's a panacea, but you could, there are these AI apps, if you will, that will record the interaction between the patient and the clinician and then generate a note at the end. So such that the clinician doesn't have to take the amount of time, effort, and energy to document the interaction, which for me was very time consuming because many of the patients I saw, frankly, had many different medical conditions that required a lot of time to document. But the AI might be something in the future that could generate a document or note, if you will, of the interaction, allowing the clinician to really practice the way I think many of us, when we go into medicine, intended to practice. So that's one thing. The other thing is that you bring up emotional intelligence. And the beautiful thing about EQ is that it's learnable. It's learnable. And we have seen in the literature and also in some of the research that I'm doing on emotional intelligence. I'm the medical director of a PA program in Syracuse, New York. We've done a lot of research on the benefits of emotional intelligence on our PA students. But the benefits of EQ lead to greater success, not only in life in general, by being able to make better decisions, be more effective, being able to develop, maintain relationships, having greater quality of life, being accomplished and feeling satisfied with the accomplishment and well-being, having physical, emotional health and balance of life. But in medicine, higher EQ practitioners have greater job satisfaction. They have greater patient satisfaction and outcomes. They're more effective in developing relationships and making decisions. It's a less risk of malpractice. They are less likely because they're able to maintain themselves and manage themselves in the relationships better, that they're less likely to burn out. the current state of affairs in medicine in general, and nursing also, is that half the clinicians, half the nurses are burnt out, and the old joke is the other half just lie about it. And the burnout, there might be multiple different reasons for it. However, emotional intelligence will benefit people who are practicing in those regards, not to mention what's in it for the organizations. Organizations that have high EQ leaders tend to be able to recruit and retain clinicians and nurses to a higher level, which if not, it's very expensive to recruit and retain. So there's high EQ leaders are able to develop a culture and a climate that people want to come and people want to stay at those organizations, allowing for greater access to medical care at those organizations, whether it be a hospital system or a physician-owned system, whatever.
What you're saying there, and I want to qualify what I'm about to say, that I believe it is the responsibility of the patient, and I'm in that category, to develop my EQ so that I'm able to sort of take responsibility for my half of the connection that I have between myself and my doctor, right? I again, we talk offline, so our audience, Mickey and I go a way back, so there's many conversations that happen that aren't recorded. Mentioning to you about, I had a conversation with my doctor, and there was a suggestion about me taking a specific drug, and I don't feel comfortable with that drug, right? So stop there. What am I feeling? I'm feeling some apprehension. I'm feeling some, maybe a little discomfort, if all of that, right? In our world, what we practice is, what is that telling you? What's the message behind the apprehension? Well, for me, and that is that I've had other doctors that really were going to try to force the issue, and I don't do well with that. Mickey, if my wife would probably be the first to say that Eric has problems with authority, and she would be right. But I had apprehension that here we go, this is going to be somebody that's going to try to force me to do it, and that's not going to happen because I'll fight back, right? So what I did is, in that moment, I pivoted to humor, and I said something to the effect of, the only way I would ever take that drug is if the Grim Reaper was knocking at my door. And I said, I know that might make you want to fire me as a patient. Her response was a smile and a little chuckle. I understand. But would you be willing to? Now, see, though I can't say that everyone's experience should or would be like that, Mickey, I go, that to me is a two-way connection that is pretty solid, right? And I think, yes, as a patient, I got to be aware of that. But I also think that the emotional connection between the patient and the physician is so vitally important, because we could discuss all the times. I mean, you gave one a great example with your granddaughter. There was a very competent orthopedic surgeon, probably knew things inside and out, probably had multiple awards for the work, but could not do that vital thing, which is, how am I making this family feel? What would that little girl feel? What is she feeling right now, knowing that she's not going to be probably able to dance until next season? That has to be factored in. I mean, where would you go with that? Maybe that's a veiled way of me saying, how do we build that emotional connection even more so?
It goes back to the paradigm of emotional intelligence, and I know we're going to be eventually talking about my book called The EQ Prescription, but in that book I talk about what I think is a transformative novel concept called the emotional intelligence zone, and there's really two different concepts that I combined into one. And both of the concepts are well known and well described. The one is emotional intelligence, and that was made famous by Pete Salovey and John Mayer back in 1990, and then really brought to light by Daniel Goleman in 1995 in his book emotional intelligence, why it may matter more than IQ. That emotional intelligence is well described. There's been many, many books written about it. But the other thing that I've added was this concept called the zone, which was made famous by a woman and her group, Elaine Miller-Harris, who developed this trauma resilience model. And the zone is really just a visual of two horizontal lines. It's not very complicated at all. And when you're between those two lines, you're your best self. Now, naturally, things in life will narrow your zone, like not enough sleep or being hangry or too much to do and not enough time to do it. And things in life will widen your zone, like getting a compliment or being well fed or having a good night's sleep. So the what I'm trying to say is that for the clinician, I think that they have to have some level of self-awareness. And if you're self-aware, then you'll know if you're in your zone, and you'll know if it's narrow or wide, or if you're bummed out, for that matter. So emotional, I combine the two, and the first step is, okay, recognize the zone. But how do you know if you're in your zone or not? And that has to do with self-awareness. So the clinician needs to say, hey, right now my zone is narrow because I'm being rushed, because I have a whole waiting room worth of people who still need to be seen. So I'm feeling a little rushed right now. So let me be self-aware about that. Let me be socially aware and recognize that Eric is not feeling comfortable with my recommendation to take this particular medication. And I could recognize that because I could see and I could hear what he's saying. And then based upon that, how am I going to manage myself as a clinician in that situation so that I can develop that relationship with Eric, such that he would be willing to take this medication that I think will give him benefit? So I think that this emotional intelligence zone, it would be perfect for that particular clinician to recognize all those particular elements when they are recommending a treatment. So as an example, one of the responses could be based upon what you said and what they saw, your body language, your facial expression is, help me understand what's your concern about that medication. What are the barriers that are holding you back from taking that medication? Help me understand, because I could see that you're not comfortable with my
And
recommendation.
you know what's interesting? And I'm sorry, Mickey, I'm interrupting you, but you number one, this is fabulous. This emotional intelligence zone, I could probably sit here with you for hours just listening to that, how it plays out. So what I'm thinking about is if I'm in her shoes, speaking about my interaction, and I go, okay, maybe this is the time for my consequential thinking. I am in that narrow zone because, like Mickey just described, I got tons of patients are waiting. We're behind. I look at Eric. I can see he's in shape. I can look at his background, his A1C, his all of the different things, and that's really solid. Is this really a hill that I need to fight on today? Is Eric at the brink of life and death? Or could this be a day, Eric, I'd like you to think about it. And when you come back in 3 months, let's look at the numbers again. And let's see where we go. There's no major threat. It's not like, hey, this guy has a cholesterol level of 400 and he's overweight and he's got type 2 diabetes. I mean, all the different things that would say, whoa, time out, ring the bell. And I think, just for audience and for you, I think she did that. I don't know if she was conscious of it, like maybe you and I are in the practice of EQ of going, whoa, this is the time. Now, I'd love to see a day where physicians were practicing it, going, okay, consequential thinking, okay, empathy, okay, optimism. Because that's when I think emotional intelligence is on. I mean, that's where it's getting really, really good. But to your point, having that awareness, yeah, I think that can definitely make a difference, not only in how they behave, but how the patient would receive that information.
Yeah, no, there's again, there's a lot to unpack in your description. And there's happily, especially when it comes to some conditions, there are alternatives also to the maybe the most common one or the most popular one. So is there an opportunity to say, hey, I recognize, because I have felt like you have felt, uncomfortable with with some recommendation that somebody has made to me in the past.
Yeah, whether it was medical or otherwise,
Yeah,
right?
I've been there. I've been there. So I know what that might feel like, and I can get a sense for what Eric might be feeling in that situation. So rather than saying my way or the highway, and I'm not saying suggesting that your clinician did that, but it could be my way or the highway for some, because I don't really have time right now to talk about this. But to say I could recognize that you're uncomfortable, there are alternatives to this. Here's a list of alternatives that I'm offering you, and then it sounds like it looks like you're the type of person, patient, who likes to do some additional investigation. I welcome that. I welcome that. And when you come back, let's have a discussion about which might be the best for you that would give you the greatest benefit and reduce your risk. And if that was explained to you maybe in those particular terms, and again, I was in the room with you and your clinician, but I could just even see, based upon your response to what I just said, that might have landed a little bit better.
Yeah,
That
because
would
you know what, Mickey, this is not, I mean, and I this is where I think patients and our society as a whole, I think we've placed way too much pressure on physicians for answers. And this is just my personal opinion that somehow if I go to see you and there's something wrong, you're going to tell me what the answer is to fix it and make it better so that I can keep going on with my life. And I think some of that is a veiled way in which we shift responsibility to others when it should be on ourselves, right? And I'm going in this direction because to say, maybe this is not the right physician for you. Maybe it's not the right patient for you. And it doesn't have to be a contentious, angry split. It could just be it's just not a fit. And that's okay. I mean, I think about the work that we do. Not every customer was the right customer or right client, right? And again, I think if maybe we would shift, take back some of the responsibility we have to manage our life, our lifestyle, right? And then recognize that maybe this particular clinician is not going to give me the answer in 10 minutes. It might be something that's going to need to be looked at further with nuance.
Jeff, what is the SEQ Development Report?
I'm glad you asked me that, Eric. The SEQ Development Report is something that we here at Spirit of EQ have developed to blend the idea of emotional intelligence with a person's spiritual life. And we're not talking about religion, we're talking about how they connect with themselves, other people, and the world around them.
Why is it important?
I think it's important because it allows someone to see where they stand, to give them information about maybe parts of their life they may need to work on, parts of their life that they're really doing well and learn to leverage it. And it just gives a person a better way of getting through the world.
So how do you get this report?
Well, first, you need to contact us. Info at Spirit of EQ is just a great way to do it. Then you would take an assessment, 15, 20 minutes, done online. And then after that, the report requires a debrief to go through all the things in it because it's got a ton of information. And then if you want to further your journey, we can do coaching and things like that with you down the road. And that's basically it.
Cool. Thanks, Jeff. And we'll be back to the episode after this. And now back to the episode.
But let me pivot
Well,
because.
let me just before we move on from this, because you're bringing up another really important point about emotional intelligence, and I talk about this. I give a lot happily. I've had the opportunity to give a lot of talks on EQ, and one of the things that I talk about when it comes to self-awareness and actually connects with social awareness is something called brain talents or brain preferences. And so this might sound crazy, and I'm making a little joke, but I tell my audience that, as it turns out, not everybody might think in the exact way that you think. So I've actually come up with the term, and I don't know if it's unique to me or that but you have to be as a clinician a clinical chameleon. A clinical chameleon. That is to say that I need to adjust to you as the patient. So for some patients, that I might need to say, this is what I think you need to do, and be very direct based upon their brain preferences and how they think about life. And they might just want to be told, do this. And the patient would say, yes, if you recommend it, I'll do it. But for other patients, I as a clinical chameleon need to recognize that Eric likes to think a little more broadly about his treatment options. Mm-hmm. He wants to have a little more control over what he puts in his body. And so I, as the clinical chameleon, needs to recognize that for you, I need to be different. I need to approach your case differently than for somebody else who just needs to be told, take this medicine, take it at 9 o'clock in the morning, take it with a full glass of water, and that's it.
Yeah.
For others, yeah, that might not work. And my job is to figure out what will work. And I think that all goes back to EQ.
Yeah, you hit it. The reason why I said I have to pivot, Mickey, is because what always happens with you and I in our conversations, there's never enough time. But right. I want to shift and pivot sort of in this last segment about your book. I know you wrote the first one, which I think was phenomenal. And then the second one, I don't necessarily think you're building upon what you wrote the first time around, but can you tell our audience a bit about what's the book about? And maybe what was motivating you to write this second one?
Right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about that. Yeah. You know, the first book I wrote after I was just really disappointed about how medicine was being practiced. Mm-hmm. And so I had high expectations, and I was disappointed. And I wrote the book to basically get it off my chest. I just wanted to let people know that the system was really beating down really good people who really were dedicated and committed to taking care of patients. And so I wrote the book, but in the end, I really didn't have a good solution to how to manage the system. Mm-hmm. And what I wrote in the last chapter, and I maybe a little bit funny, maybe a little embarrassing, is I said, you have to put all the peas in the pod, and you go, what the heck does that mean? Well, as it turns out, all the players, and the book has a lot of sports metaphors in it, but all the players in the game start with the letter P. Everything from the practitioners, the physicians, to the patients, to the pharma, to the plaintiffs, to the payers, to the politicians, they all start with the letter P. So put them in a pod and don't let them out until they figure out what's best for most, recognizing that not everybody is going to get what they want.
Yeah.
And that was my solution. And I was like, that's weak. That's never.
Well, it was a noble attempt. I will give you that.
It was a noble attempt, but that wasn't going to happen. So right. For the last many years, I've been thinking like, what is the solution?
Right.
Short of the people who oversee and administer the healthcare system, short of them changing it to make it more sustainable for really, really great people. I can't say enough about the people who are willing to commit their lives and dedicate their lives to helping other people at their most vulnerable time. You know, as clinicians of all types, nurses who are amazing individuals, you know, students in healthcare education programs. What is the solution short of all the administrative changing the system to make it more palatable and livable for all of my teammates? So a few years ago, a friend of mine talked to me about this emotional intelligence. I go, what is this emotional intelligence? So I started exploring it. And through the good work of 6 Seconds, which is an internationally known company that teaches and researches emotional intelligence, I, along with you, Eric, and that's where you and I met, received and earned all these certifications in emotional intelligence as an assessor, practitioner, facilitator, brain preferences, and as a coach. And I was like, man, this is it. This is the answer. And the reason why it's the answer is because I can't, it comes down to this old riddle. What can I control and what can I control? And the answer is the only thing that I can really control is me. And so how do you control yourself and manage yourself to stay in practice and not leave prematurely, not being beaten up, broken down, and burnt out and wanting to get out, is to be able to manage yourself. And that's when I came up with the book, and I called it, and I have just by chance,
Ah, good
I have
chance.
the cover, which I helped to design. I don't know if it's easily seen.
That's okay. And you know
Okay.
what I will tell you too, Mickey, as we're talking. So for our audience, no worries. We'll have all of Mickey's information if the image on the screen wasn't the greatest for you. So we'll have links to the Amazon site as well as his background information. So we're all good there. But Mickey, continue on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I thought that the best way to manage the system is to be able to manage yourself and get yourself through all these situations and that continually find us. I mean, practicing medicine is high pressure, and it's one thing to be able to get through your day when the waters are calm and the skies are blue and the stress is under control, but the reality is, in medicine, the waters are always rough, the skies are always stormy, and the stress is always high. So
Yeah.
how do you manage yourself so that you're able to sustain yourself, sustain your practice, give the type of care that you really want to deliver and patients want to see? It really comes down to this, and that is, in order to give your best care and patients receive the best care that they would like, you have to be your best. And how do you be your best? You have to be well. And how do you be well? You have to take care of you, be well physically and emotionally. You have to take care of yourself first. And the best way to take care of yourself first is using this emotional intelligence zone, recognizing what your zone is, if it's wide, if it's narrow, if you're bumped out high, bumped out low. And then how do you know if you're in your zone or not? And that all comes down to emotional intelligence, being self-aware. How do you know if the person you're interacting with is in their zone or not? Because that could change your whole dynamic. So if you, as an example, ever came into to my exam room and you were in a narrow zone or even bumped out of your zone, irritated, agitated, angry, then I might that whole conversation might be different than if you were in your zone. So I have to be able to recognize that, and that comes down to social awareness. And based upon my zone and your zone, how do I manage myself? What do I do? What do I say that's going to allow me to have a good relationship with you so that you trust me, you're willing to follow my recommendations? And then in the end, what do I really want with each interaction? What do I want in broad sense? Like I told you, mine is tikkun olam, to make the world better. But what do I want each day, and what do I want with each interaction? And frankly, what do I want to avoid? And I think this all emotional intelligence, this EQ zone, allows the clinician, the nurse, students who are trying to get through all the different tests that they need to take and all the stuff that they need to learn. How do you get through all this when the stakes are high and the pressures are really high? And I think the EQ zone allows you to do that, to manage yourself, because you can't change the system.
Yes, and I applaud you in that, Mickey, because I think where people get frustrated and are probably less prone to innovation is when they keep their eye on the system, which is very much like the circumstances, right? Those that keep themselves fixated on that will tend to get frustrated, will tend to give up, right? But the way I look at it, and I think this has application even beyond medicine, is that, if I have the power to make a positive change in another human's life, I should take that opportunity, no doubt. And if I get 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, whatever it may be, over whatever span of time, I should take that opportunity because it's in my control. And I think when it's in your control, then kind of shifts to it's kind of your responsibility to do that. But no one's given me control or the responsibility of the healthcare system.
Exactly.
It hasn't been given to me. So if it's not in my control, and it's not my responsibility. Maybe I should work on that one person I'm interacting with today. And maybe it's five people, maybe it's three, maybe it's 10, whatever it may be. And I think that not only is more effective, but it's probably going to leave me more mentally and emotionally healthy, you know?
Agreed. Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me is from the studies, from the 6-second studies, and from the studies that I've done in my PA program, is that and I've also coached, you know, many students and clinicians and nurses, is that their consequential thinking, their logic is very high,
yep.
But their ability to navigate their emotions is lower. In fact, it's the lowest. And that's not just my studies, it's the state of the heart. 6 seconds has shown this in their studies. And the challenge with the inability to adequately navigate your emotions is that we are emotional beings, whether we accept it or not. We have a whole portion of our brain called the limbic system that's dedicated to emotions. And if we're not able to manage and navigate those emotions, especially when we're heavily on logic side, then we might get frustrated even more easily than if our emotional ability to navigate emotions was higher. And so I think that, again, there's skills to be able to do that, to be able to navigate your emotions better. And that's what I describe in the book on how do you do it. People say, oh, you should navigate your emotions better. You should develop relationships. You should develop trust. You know, and the question is, how do you do that? You know, I was talking to a CEO of a major hospital organization, and when I was a quality director, and they said to me, how do you get things done? And I said, well, I develop relationships with people. And they go, well, how do you do that? And I was like, really? You're the CEO, you know, develop relationships. They go, well, I said, well, I develop trust. And they said, well, how do you do that? And I'm like, really? My. If you're the CEO and you don't know how to develop relationships and trust, then maybe it's not as well known as everybody might think it is. And therefore, maybe there's some education and skills that could be developed to help develop those relationships and trust, with the outcomes being enormous, which I mentioned earlier, with job satisfaction, et cetera.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe on that note, that's what makes EQ such a hope-filled practice, because it's learnable. It's learnable.
That's the beauty. If you told me my emotional intelligence scores were this and I can't do anything about it, not so interested. But if
my
emotional intelligence scores are this and I can make this, hey, I'm very interested.
Right. And Mickey, this is so interesting because, you know, when we typically are having that at discovery meeting with a client, you know, they'll ask questions like, well, you know, how's your customer, your clients, you know, what is their, what do they look like? And what is it that they do to learn and to, and I'll tell them, and it's true. They're really the most common of denominators for the work that we do and with our clients. The difference is between those who are willing to put in the work and those that are not. It's not education level. It's not money status. It's not job title, not education from a formal perspective, but it's the willingness. And I firmly believe, give me the person who has limited fill-in-the-blank resources, who's willing to show up every day and put in the work, versus the most highly educated resources to the nth degree every day. Because that person that's willing to put in the work is going to get results.
It reminds me, your comments remind me of another riddle, which is, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is one, but the light bulb has to want to change. So, you know, I always ask people, do you want to be that light bulb or not?
Oh my gosh.
And Einstein said one of the signs of great intelligence is the willingness to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Mickey, I'm so glad that you decided to carve out some time for our show today.
Oh, it's always my... Oh, come on, Eric. I love talking. Let's keep going, man. What do we...
Well, I know. Now? But remember, I am not Joe Rogan, nor am I Andrew Huberman. So having said that, what you've offered up is so great. And for our audience, all the information that you'll need from Mickey, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mickey, the book will be officially released on October 7th. Am I right in that?
Absolutely. Amazon.com, okay. October 7th. Okay. Looking
All
forward
right.
to it.
So yeah. Everyone look for that. It'll be in the show notes. We'll have Mickey's contact information if you want to reach out to him, if there's something maybe, and this is certainly my hope, is that maybe there's someone out there in the healthcare world that goes, I want to learn more about, and I want to, because this is something we should look at, because I think that's just a great ripple effect. But with that, thank you again, Mickey, and for
thanks,
our audience.
Thanks for the opportunity. EQ4healthcare.com is my website. I hope people check it out. I'm happy to come to your place and talk more about this. I could talk about this all day. It's just it's my second favorite topic. Of course, my first favorite is my three granddaughters. But
yeah, I was going to say that was going to
close second.
That was going to be my guess. And for our audience, thank you for tuning in as always, and we look forward to the next time that we're together. Take care.
Thanks, Eric.
Hi everyone, this is Eric Pennington with the Spirit of EQ. I'm not introducing a new episode today. I'm here to tell you some things that might help you. Jeff, you're with me as always. So
yes.
How do people get in touch with us?
Well, the best way is just send us an email at info@spiritofeq.com.
That's awesome. Jeff, I was also thinking about reviews, and I'm notoriously bad at asking for them. So reviews on all of the platforms, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes.
You think that'd be good?
I think that would be great because one, that will help us learn how to make better ones. And it's always good for us.
So we're not the perfect podcast host.
We're close.
Okay, all right,
but
still,
not totally.
We want
perfect.
Your feedback. We want your feedback.
But it also might let us know a new subject. Hey, we need to dig deeper into that.
Yeah.
So let us know what you think.
Cool. We really appreciate that. As always, too, there is social media: LinkedIn, Facebook, and we also have a YouTube channel. Those also have mechanisms or options for you to be able to leave a comment, a like, or those kind of things. Just want to make sure that you know how to get in touch with us. Right, Jeff?
Right. We appreciate you all.
Thank you. Once again, we really appreciate you tuning in today. One of the things that Jeff and I want to bring to your attention as well is that when we created this podcast, it was not intended to take the place of a clinician. In other words, if you find yourself in a place where there's something deeper going on or something that you cannot solve on your own, we do recommend that you reach out to a clinician of some sort. This podcast is purely opinion-based, and it is rooted in the desire to help you along your path in whatever way we can. However, it is never going to replace, nor should it ever be looked at as a replacement for clinical help in any way. Thanks again for tuning in.